Welcome to a new episode of Digging a Hole, the Legal Theory Podcast, where my co-host Sam Moyen and I, David Schlegger, talk about legal theory and whatever else is on our minds. And we have a wonderful guest on to talk about it with us. So who do we have with us today, Sam?
It's a great episode that it involves Maggie Blackhawk of Penn and Casey Park of Georgetown, both of them doing a novel scholarship about Native peoples of the Americas and the way that their treatment and frameworks around their struggles have been fundamental in the making of the legal order.
It's a really wonderful discussion. I can't wait for you all to hear it. So without further ado, let's get to it.
All right. Well, today it's our treat to welcome two of the most exciting scholars in law schools and in our moment. They're Maggie Blackhawk and Kaisu Park. Maggie is now a tenured professor at University of Pennsylvania Law School. And she has many writings, but we're going to focus the discussion. She's welcome to raise other things on her article, Federal Indian Law as a Paradigm Within Public Law, in the Harvard Law Review 2019. Kaisu Park is teaching at the Georgetown University Law Center. We want to ask questions about this exciting new piece, Conquest and Slavery as Foundational to Property Law. So welcome to you both.
Thank you. Thank you.
There are some obvious resemblances between these two pieces and between the posture of some of your work in general, though by no means identity. And I think we want to explore how there are similarities and differences. But just as a starter, I wonder if you both could take a turn to describe the claims you're making about the exclusion of legal treatment of Native peoples in America has affected scholarship and teaching in particular, and how you might envision a better integration than has been the case so far.
I think this is something that Maggie and I have in common, is that we're pretty concerned about the erasures in legal scholarship and legal pedagogy and people's understanding of the law in general. And there's so many different ways into that problem. In this last particular piece, I've done it different ways in different times, but in this last particular piece that you read that we're talking about today, I wanted to think about the field of property law and understand something about how it came to be taught the way it is taught, in addition to the way that I have developed my own understanding of the field of property law and how it has evolved historically over time and what accounts for the huge gaps between those. And so, as you know, I spend about a third of the piece going back through the history of property law case books to see, what kinds of information they contained about conquest or enslavement. And it tells a very particular story about erasure that is different for each one of those histories, but between the two shows a really clear pattern of suppression, I would say. Explaining why that is not a really key part of what we learn in property law classes today.
Could you just give us a little bit more of the detail in the paper about kind of like how this information has figured or it actually not figured in property casebooks over time? And the extent to which there's been any correction in your view in our present situation.
Sure. Yeah. So I can boil down that story. It is a pretty boiled down story anyway. Of course, the whole history of legal education could be a lot longer and more involved. These books are just one measure. You know, I think it's uncontroversial that we all use case books and they've been a really dominant staple of legal education for 130 years. The story I basically describe in that paper is modern legal education beginning during the era of Jim Crow. The first case books being published at a time when the U.S. Census Bureau is declaring the frontier closed and the United States is eager to move on from its aggressive westward expansion and conquest of Native nations' lands to thinking about their place among other nations, the nations of Europe in particular, and looking back to English heritage and citing a lot of English case law. And so what I describe is you see this in the way that legal treatises really avowed conquest, were really quite proud of this process of conquest and tracking the transfer of lands through treaties or purchases with other European nations after the conquest of those lands from native nations to the United States. This difference between a legal treatise tradition that really was very open about that to case books where you really don't see a trace of it. There's really barely a trace of it, beginning with the first one, John Shipman Gray's in 1888. It's a whole lot of English feudal law, a lot of stuff about sub-infeudation and you know, sort of crown grants to different monasteries and knights and so on and so forth. And this really sort of set a framework for understanding the history of property law, which persisted for a very, very long time. So from the beginning, there was fairly complete erasure of the history of conquest. The history of slavery is different. For the first several decades of property law case books, you see a fairly large number of cases involving this illegal, obsolete form of property in enslaved people. Casebooks don't explain this system. They don't talk about the legacy of this history. They just present it as a natural fact. The number of cases involving property in enslaved people dwindles in the 1930s. And by the mid-40s, it's completely gone. And then you have this period of total erasure. I noted as an interesting kind of fact that as those cases involving property and enslaved people dropped out, casebooks also seem to incorporate cases upholding racially restrictive covenants, which were illegal at the time. It's odd, that timing, because that practice of using racially restrictive covenants actually began in the 1890s and became very widespread by the 1910, 1911. And so it's quite a delay, you know, three decades later to start to incorporate these as this other type of case representing racial subordination drops out. Nevertheless, there is this whole period of kind of confusion, definite erasure of the history of slavery. And then it's not till the 1970s that you see a couple of casebook authors making a move to bring these histories back in.
Great. So, you know, we definitely want to turn to the question of remediation, but maybe it's appropriate to kind of ask Maggie, looking at con law and public law generally, like what are the omissions and or at least marginalization that you see and you think it is persistent enough to kind of require the amazing piece you did in the Harvard Law Review?
Thank you. I wrote that piece in 2019 against a backdrop of not only the erasure of Native people and the history of American colonialism from public law generally, but in particular constitutional law casebooks. So I did a similar survey at that time on con law casebooks for reference to Native people versus reference to slavery, and found that there were few to none in the context of the reference to Native people. So the erasure was pretty easy to document. Although I took the first half of the piece to try and show that that erasure was misplaced. But I was also writing against the explanation for the erasure of Native people that rested in an argument that federal Indian law was sui generis and was so counterintuitive that it couldn't be integrated with the general principles of American public law and constitutional law generally. And even against a presumption, both in the doctrine as well as by the legal academy, that federal Indian law was not, quote, constitutional law. And so the literature was essentially piled up against that article. And I spent quite a bit of it trying to both show that the erasure of Native people was misplaced, of not only that Native people and American colonialism was central to the development of a wide range of public law doctrines, but also that the integration of Native people and American colonialism, it was not the reason that was explained at the time, which was this idea that it was so sui generis as to not fit. And the argument I made in that piece was that rather than federal Indian law needing to stay out of these general principles, it was really these general principles that needed to be rethought and changed. And that the integration of Native people and American colonialism into our understanding of the development of public law in the United States could help us add nuance and better develop those principles to better capture not just the constitutional failure of human enslavement, but that of the violent dispossession of indigenous peoples' property, land, cultures, children in some instances. And I gave a big example in that the second part of that piece. And it was with respect to the presumption that we usually hold in constitutional law that the best way to protect minorities is through federal oversight, judicial solicitude, and federal rights and rights in general. So that liberal egalitarian framework of this is what we normally do to protect minorities. If you look at the history of American colonialism, it teaches the opposite, that federal oversight was actually responsible for some of the most egregious atrocities within Indian country, that rights more often wounded rather than shielded Native people from those atrocities, and judicial solicitude actually in the beginning was at best problematic and overly deferential, and most at present is really problematic.
So, there's a ton there. I want to start to get in with to kind of how we might kind of on the basis of these reframings begin to remediate. I even just at the level of teaching, but also, much more broadly. And what I want to single out, at least at the start, is a couple of characteristic moves, not the one you just made, Maggie, but it's in your piece and also in Kesu's piece. Let's call it the first about tainted origins of doctrine. And let's call the other tainted origins of outcomes. So there's just a ton in both pieces that I think could fall in these categories. And what I want to hear about is what you do with, pushback that might kind of, let's say blithely acknowledge this dark past, but say we've moved on. There were many other factors. I'm just going to cite a couple of examples just to keep it in this glorious podcast. We had on in one of our early episodes Adam Cox and Christina Rodriguez, and thinking about the origins of the contemporary immigration regime, and invoking you, Maggie, I asked them about their skepticism about stories of an enduring plenary power doctrine. They even in cases like Che Chan Ping say it wasn't at work and say there's some radical novelty in Trump v. Hawaii, which is very much not the story you tell. For KSU, we had our colleague Claire Priest on, who does a lot with slaves as property, but insists that the pivotal fact is their use as collateral for credit as part of the kind of birth of American capitalism, kind of across the board in thinking about the property regime and how important it was for American growth, which we know and love. So I guess I want to get from you. What do we say once we've identified these tainted origins or tainted results from those who, say we've, there are these other sources or, on balance, it worked out well?
Sure. I think, it's an interesting way to present it, tainted origins or tainted outcomes. I just don't think about it as a question of taint. I think that's kind of the wrong framework. I think that these histories, people have a hard time with them. They have a hard time with them because there is very little education about them. They have very few ways to wrap their minds around them. They've been suppressed for so long that even people who are fairly knowledgeable about a lot of American history and law, all of our colleagues, are kind of thrown out of their element when confronted with these histories. And one really common reaction I get to my work when I present it, I think you've seen this, Sam, is this idea, well, those histories were just all violent, but that's separate from law, right? That was just genocide, and we should tell people about the genocide, but That's different from law. We have all these received understandings about law and how it's good and it facilitates people's lives and makes it better and easier and so on and so forth. The kind of liberal narrative that Maggie was pointing to in her last answer, right? The solution is to kind of extend that to everybody. You see that a lot in conversations about credit, right? The answer to people's financial problems is just to get everyone access to credit. It's a great thing. I actually think Claire's work is so important in this respect. When you look back at this long history, she's completely right to point out, to point to the use of enslaved peoples as collaterals for developing the credit system at all. And there's other scholars who've talked about this. People like Joseph and Inokori have looked at the development of these huge bureaucratic credit systems that come out of the slave trade. I, as you know, have also looked at this question with respect to land. And I think it's really notable that before the colonization of the Americas, you know, this type of use of land as collateral, ending in easy foreclosure that would just throw a family off of their homes, out in the world with nothing, no way to survive, just wasn't something that just wasn't something that happened. There were so many protections to prevent against that, recognizing the massive social instability of having such a mechanism in place for non-payment of an unsecured debt to just cast a family out. There were just a lot of different legal mechanisms that made it very difficult to make that happen, which Claire has written about extensively. I've written about it as well. But when you begin the colonization, when you launch the colonization enterprise, what you really see is a willingness to experiment, I think, with known forms of transactions, but introduce greater violence. There's just no question that there was more leeway when it came to violence and infringement on aspects of people's lives that law has otherwise protected and that societies have held sacred. So almost as soon as colonists came over, they began to foreclose on Native nations' land. They began processes of lending that we could only describe as predatory, and then tallying up those debts and taking land as a result, and transactions that were not understood, not clear. And as I have said in an earlier paper, you know, if that was confusing to Native people who were getting their land taken because they owed so many shillings for bolts of cloth they took from the store, it would have been pretty unrecognizable to English people as well. That was just not something that was routinely happening. And so my interest in these evolutions from this period that we don't learn about is how our law has changed. Routine, easy foreclosure is central to our entire real estate system now. There is no flow of credit without the ability to foreclose in this way fairly easily. It makes the whole thing run. And that has been true for some time. And I think Claire in her work is tracking some of the evolutions of that with respect to the slave trade. And there was a lot of really interesting legal experimentation and developments in how to categorize lands that had just been taken from Native people, enslaved human beings, as collateral in order to keep plantations whole. And her work has done a lot to uncover that. And my work has also investigated this dimension. That is an unmistakably racial project where racial formation is used as a resource that makes people more willing to experiment with violence. There is more violence that becomes a way of producing more liquidity. Frankly, I just don't know how else to describe it. And those are evolutions we have with our law still, even as the formal boundaries, you know, this kind of practice is only applicable to Native people or to Black people, even as those have been lifted, the kinds of mechanisms we have in law that infringe upon people's basic security and ability to stay in their homes, we still have that as a mechanism for producing credit flows, born out of experimentation that is easier to popularize when you use it against communities of color, the community you're trying to colonize, the community that you've enslaved. And so what I'm interested in is the way that racial formation is a resource for this type of economic development, and still is. It's really hard to argue that it is not. I mean, this is a dynamic system still in flux. I don't know how you could argue that race doesn't play a role in it, right? It just does. And there's recycling of old methods. There's the invention of new methods. This is something I saw as an attorney as well, as constant innovation as to new different kinds of form of lending and foreclosure. used on really vulnerable populations.
So my mistaken language of taint, the trouble there is that it restricts the phenomenon to the past, when the whole point is that it's ongoing and structural ways that are open, not hidden.
I think that's right. But I also think the very word taint suggests that there's pure, like there's something essential and good. And then there's the kind of infection that we can remove. Yeah.
So I think that I agree with Kesu's logic around tracking, to understand the way a government works, to understand the logic of the treatment of certain people at the margins, we have to understand, we have to see the whole elephant. We can't just look at part of it. And I worry that the sort of legal theory argument of, is this tainted origins of the doctrine, so should we throw it out, kind of overlooks what it is that at least my project is trying to accomplish in its use of history. It's not trying to bring in this history to say, look, okay, the roots of this tree are tainted such that we need to, you know, extract it root and branch. Rather, the logics of a doctrine, the logics of a system are not apparent unless we see the whole system for what it is. And so if you only look at part of that system, which is what we've done in all of these other things, by taking them out of our mainstream constitutional law discussion, theorization. So we don't even talk about this in the context of good governance anymore. Immigration laws taken out, the territories are taken out, federal Indian laws taken out. All of those things have been taken out. And that's a logic in itself, right? And so we've taken that out of its own discussion of good governance. And then we've taken them into little subsections and talked about them separate from this broader project of good constitutional governance. And that to me sounds wrong. So bringing them back into discussions of good constitutional governance is a good move, right? And so seeing the connections between their exclusion is helpful for reintegrating these conversations into our understandings of government. One thing that's helpful is to see the continuities once we bring them in, and to understand why these logics working together is important, right? So these are all parts of the same elephant. And it's hard to totally disagree with that when you actually start to look in the nitty-gritty empiricism of how these things are working together. So the same forts that were used to indefinitely detain Native people, including Native families across generations as part of the, quote, Indian Wars. And I understand that's not immigration doctrine, but it's really hard to tease out foreign international law in the long 19th century from domestic law, given the shape of the United States. We didn't run from coast to coast as much as the colonists wanted to be that way from the very beginning. This was not a sea to shining sea conversation. The mechanics got us there, right? And so we need to understand how those mechanics work, and the fact that they were interacting both with international law and these areas that came to be codified and crystallized of immigration law, federal Indian law, which was codified and brought into a treatise in the 20th century. They were just messy business of governance, right? They didn't become these treatises until much later. But the logics of them are the same. The material of them is the same. So two of the Japanese internment camps were on reservations, Indian reservations, because the same material mechanics were getting used. The same doctrine was getting used. The same people were running the programs in both instances. And so to overlook those logics and to overlook the similarities, I think is to miss a conversation about good governance that's starting to carve it off into pieces and going, okay, well, in this area, did we do an okay job? Sure, maybe we're doing an okay job over here in this particular instance, but I think there's an interesting story to be told where it doesn't, it's not a partisan story either. It's not a story that's rooted in a particular administration, but it's across administrations, there's a continuity, and to be able to understand the logics of that. And as lawyers, to understand the way that law and the institutions of law are participating in that, even if it's just through an exclusion, right, of how we think and talk about governance. So that's one side. The other side is this idea of history and what work is history doing. So there's the idea of the outcomes. So I've given a lot of thought to the use of this history, and it's not usually it gets invoked by folks to say, oh, is this a tainted origins argument? And the reality is it's not. And I'm unpacking this a bit more in a piece that I have forthcoming in a Supreme Court review on McGirt v. Oklahoma, to think about what history is actually doing, because it does a lot of work within federal Indian law. It did a lot of work in McGirt, because it rather than just showing that the history was tainted, there it's actually a positive history. It's a history of treaties. It's a history of the existence of Native people, which is it's not a story of tainted origins at all. It actually is a history that's interrogating a dominant ideology that we hold, that we even hold in the legal academy, that erases Native people, that erases people at the margins, and it basically entrenches the power structures under which we all participate and live. And the history is doing work. I think your colleague, Professor Gorski in the sociology department, has done some interesting work around Bourdieu and Foucault, and the work that history is doing to unsettle these presumptions, these natural ways of being. And I think bringing this in is starting to denaturalize a vision of Native people as not existing. It's starting to denaturalize a vision of majority-minority governance never existing within the United States. It's starting to denaturalize a vision of subordinating Black people or people of African descendancy as just a part and parcel thing that used to happen and now is over. And you can start to see what work history is doing. And it's something that's very distinct from your traditional legal argument of, okay, well, this is it started in a bad place. And so we need to get rid of it. We can't cite Dred Scott because it's anti-canon. If Dred Scott kept on finding racialized categories of people who were not going to be citizens, I think we'd have a problem with that doctrine. And I think that's what you see in the context of the plenary power doctrine. And so tracing it back to Rogers and understanding its roots in the reservation system and these forms of indefinite detention that looked a lot like the immigration system that came 100 years later, I think it's important. And we should probably reflect on those similarities.
So Maggie, I've got questions for both of you. This has been really interesting. I want to ask you, is being a backwater bad? So one of the things that we kind of in study of modern Congress we've seen is that that things get done despite gridlock and policy outcomes come out and decent policy outcomes come out when no one's paying any attention. But as soon as people start paying attention, everything goes haywire, everyone goes to their camps. Things like that don't happen. So energy bill, money laundering. But a rising profile creates polarization, which then creates particular political logics. And the same thing might be true on the court that you noted in McGirt, as Gorsuch goes with the liberals. And across all of these issues, you have strange bedfellows, ideologically strange bedfellows. It makes ideological, but it's not necessarily polarized. And you note several times that greatest success tribes have had is in kind of the bowels of the administrative state. It's been in the, when it's quiet, when people, and so I wonder, and by the way, at the same time, you have canonized opinions falling left and right, Voting Rights Act, for example, canonized cases get decanonized. And so I wonder, is it the case that we think that being a backwater might be a help for tribes, tribal law? And then relatedly, it's even true for the influence. So if the influence, the history is some bad and some good, and you raise the profile, according to your terms, the bad might come out rather than the good. I thought one of the most powerful examples you just kind of assumed was the description of Osama bin Laden as Geronimo. That's a high profile, but not obviously good. So is it maybe better for people not to pay attention, even if it's untrue?
Yeah, so this is what I get at in the McGirt piece that's coming out. And it tries to unpack that moment of complete shock and awe when McGirt came out the other way, because everyone presumed that not the law, not the unanimous Supreme Court opinion that articulated a very detailed test that could only come out one direction, right? They didn't assume that was going to resolve the case. They thought they just could not possibly hold that Tulsa was within an Indian reservation. The briefs opened with a picture of Tulsa rather than legal argument made of text. It was that powerful that the visibility, that dominant ideology is presumed to do work within law. And so the moment that it gets in front of certain institutions, a court in particular, which prides itself on responding to ideology, folks who study popular constitutionalism don't talk about power and dominant ideology enough to see the work that when the court is responding to what everyone thinks, potentially that's re-entrenching power structure. So working behind the scenes, so in the piece that I'm publishing, I describe Native people as a generations old power movement, and that folks who study social movement theory really need to understand power movement dynamics equally as those to rights movements. And that power movements, rather than aiming at the dominant ideology or public discourse to then change the law, which is our model, the kind of, I know it's a bit of a straw man of the social movement model, they go to the law first. They go to formal legal texts to be able to change those, entrench the recognition of Native people. Because if we have public discourse, which is a complete erasure of Native people, they've been gone a long time, the disappearing Indian story. But if you look at the law of the United States, it is replete with recognition to Native people all over the place. So Native people have seized, repurposed, and reconstituted an entire title of the United States Code, Title 25 Indians, fractured the code to get their own little title. So, and we all know, you know, Mansur Olson, right? This is a wonderful place to start to fracture the law and wield power within this sub-discourse that has more power in it because it's law than just having a small conversation in the corner of North Dakota, for example. And then they use that law to then shift power to their communities, to build governments, to build infrastructure, and then maybe change public discourse, maybe not, because it's not necessarily the goal of power movements to change the mind of a recalcitrant nation state. Rather, it's to change the everyday lives of the people within those communities. And so working within the shadow of this dominant ideology has actually been incredibly more successful. McGirt is the exception to the rule. However, Parker v. Nebraska, unanimous opinion, because it was Pender, Nebraska, right? This tiny little place. Unanimous opinion is perfectly fine to have it within an Indian reservation. Gorsuch is the reason that McGirt made it through this very visible, very contentious space. And it's only because he has, through his experience on the 10th Circuit, really been interrogating the problems with that dominant ideology for a long time. And he's moved the way other justices have moved, like Ginsburg and Stevens. But you can see the way that ideology is working. And it would be helpful, I think, for legal theorists to understand the ways that power movements are recognizing and navigating around these social dynamics of power, including ideology, in theorizing the way law is made and the way social movements are reaching levels of reform that we're not really recognizing, and exactly the way you've described.
It's really interesting. So, and Kisu, I have to say, I was a little bit confused about the move you make to contemporary policy and the distributional effects. And so a couple times in the piece, you reference the Hernando de Sodian project of giving title. And as you note, that like clarifying title and making it something you can borrow against was a very common project in early America. It's very central to the idea of clarifying title so that people could borrow against it and as collateral. But on the other hand, giving title to squatters has a very different distributive effect than giving title to, I mean, maybe so than early American project. I mean, some things in common, some things in different. And what I'm struggling with is the legal tool, which is, you know, has distributional context and what the historical comparison does for us. Of course, there's race in it because it's a country that has race as part of its politics. And it's true in Peru, it's true in the United States, it's true everywhere. But like, does the history of title a case against recourse mortgages? And it's like I'm not quite sure how it follows. Because like recourse mortgages, we can look at whether they're good or bad now. And you know, like we may disagree, but I'm a little unclear what the kind of clear, the fact that they were useful for a purpose, again, a state purpose, does for us in our current argument over today. So I just want you to like kind of connect those dots for me.
Sure. Yeah. Thanks for that question, David. It actually helps me to clarify the purpose of the paper, which isn't to make the point you're asking for, actually. The point of this paper and the reason I start with the history of erasure is to say, look, this is the history that was constructed for the field of property law as it's been taught to generations and generations of lawyers, certainly our teachers and ourselves and who knows how many more generations. And when we learn that history, we lose all of these really, you know, important episodes in the formation of our very system. So I'm not actually trying to weigh in here. I think that this is actually the notion of taint that Sam was talking about, to say that these aspects of our system, our land system, right? Title, the mortgage, the comprehensive title registry, the survey system, all of those things, to associate them with colonization and enslavement. I think it's really hard for people to think about what that means beyond this idea of taint. It seems like that's the punchline, they're tainted. I'm not actually trying to suggest that here. I'm trying to say that we have no idea how or why we got those aspects of the system, or what they do, or what function they serve. And the question of what function they continue to serve is a long one that requires looking at the whole history of how they have developed, which I am interested in and isn't in this particular paper. I'd be happy to talk about it with you. I mean, I think that
we're on a podcast, you can freestyle a little bit. So,
well, I just wanted to clarify, because I do think that's a really common misreading of the paper. So I wanted to say that, and it has very much to do with this predominant way of thinking about these histories only in terms of taint. So it seemed important to return to the earlier point. Thanks. I would suggest that we, have an idea in property law now, in part as a result of the erasure of a lot of these histories and subsequent histories, that more liquidity is always good. I would really contest that. I would really contest that the idea of creating more and more different kinds of interests that are derivatives of interests in land, as well as different kinds of interests in land leading to more and more liquidity, which is still based on the kind of primary mechanism of foreclosure. You don't get any of that trade without being able to throw people out of their homes if they fall behind on their mortgages, is leading to vast social instability in ways that are fairly obvious to a lot of people on the ground. That's kind of a longer conversation, but that is my position, maybe at odds with your position. And I do think that we see the roots of that, the mechanisms that create that kind of liquidity in this period, and getting developed through this history in ways that they, I'm not into hypotheticals, but likely wouldn't have elsewhere. We're not on track to develop elsewhere in other countries where they had mechanisms that, you know, attached collateral to loans ever before.
Yeah, I mean, one thing I'll just say is that it's not like the other countries don't have the exact same type of stories to tell, where the lack of foreclosure is itself a product of a ongoing problematic politics of, say, elite capture or hereditary wealth, that is like you could play the story in reverse as well. It's all, yeah.
I'm definitely not trying to defend feudalism. I'm just trying to give a history of the system we do have. And I find that when people bring that up, it's more about deflecting from the story that is actually the story of our own system than engaging with it. I'm just suggesting that we might have a better conversation if we all got on board with looking at the actual history of the system we have, which has been a struggle. I mean, it really has been a struggle and pretty buried for a very, very long time. If I could respond also to your comment about being a backwater, because I'm interested in that. I mean, I think this is, you know, your question about origins versus outcome all over again. I mean, of course, we're all in the law. We're interested in outcomes. And I think at least Maggie and I are interested in practical outcomes that benefit the communities we're talking about, however they happen. So if things are happening, you know, behind closed doors to benefit populations, that is a good thing. But the costs are pretty big if they come at the expense of any literacy about the racial formation of the very systems that we have. I think we see a widespread crisis in literacy on that count. People just do not know how to talk about race. They don't know how to talk about it historically. They don't really know how to talk about it in the present. I would suggest that's most of what Twitter is today and yesterday and however many days before. And that comes in part from the fact that there's a kind of popular education project happening where a lot of people go out and self-educate, but it's not coming through our institutions. It's certainly not coming through law schools. It's not coming through business schools, I would suggest, or whatever version it has is a very narrow version of the kind that Maggie was describing earlier, right? right? There's like these certain sets of rights and we just want to distribute them out to more people. And how can we do that? But it's not a very sophisticated understanding of race and the law or how race works through institutions, which leads me to my second point. It also really risks us having a really impoverished literacy in law and legal change altogether, and the ways that these systems developed in the first place, the way that law follows collective action and material circumstance. If you study the history of colonization, that's pretty much what you see. And the kind of power Maggie's talking about, I mean, this is the power of social movements, including white supremacist movements, and what they can achieve by just changing circumstances on the ground. The law follows that. It follows that in all realms, I think, whether we're talking about, you know, sort of mass recognition of social rights or activities in private law. And this is a huge disservice to our students if we teach them that it's all about logical principle. Of course, that's an important component. We're never going to stop teaching them that. But also the way things work on the ground, the way that these things interface with power and collective organization, that is a huge part of how law has always worked, to Maggie's point. And I think that this needs, I think the students are hungry for this to be a bigger part of legal education.
I think that like we're in agreement, and it's interesting to see how much work the pronouns or maybe the lack of the inferred pronoun in David's question did a lot of work in that question. Is, does it benefit us to be a backwater, or does it benefit to be a backwater? So who does it benefit, right? It benefits Native people to be a backwater. I think it hurts us as citizens of the United States, as people, residents and people who care about government and law in the United States. I think it hurts us quite a bit to not understand how government, our own government, has worked and how it currently works. You have Native people who are governing areas that are the size of larger than states. And many people just don't believe that Native people really even exist. And many law curriculums don't have any reference to them. And so I think that there is a way that it, being a backwater, and this is the irony in my own work, because I'm, you know, writing about how wonderful it is to be a backwater. At the same time, I'm trying to canonize federal Indian law, which is really deeply schizophrenic on my part, or to use a less problematic word, a split motivation on my part. But there is a benefit to Native people, and there is a benefit to a power movement to avoid having to tussle with public discourse and dominant ideologies. But there is a problem that we have a dominant ideology that isn't actually tracking reality. So this is in Marx, this is Marx rather than Foucault here. There isn't like discourse all the way down. There is what we believe to be true, and then there's the truth, and we're missing it. And I think that's, as an academic, that ruffles my feathers. My hope is that it might ruffle the feathers of others.
Awesome. So I want to apologize first for starting us off on the wrong foot with the analogy of taint and possible purity and its and the transcendence of impurity, because I get that completely. But let me ask about frameworks for assessing continuity and change instead. So, of course, in part, in these various domains, looking at doctrines, looking at outcomes, it's a matter of fact, and you both, in brilliant ways, present all kinds of new information to think about change over time and the endurance of impurity down to our present. On the other hand, there are kind of, you know, intellectual frameworks, which I want to press you on, for kind of construing change over time and ways in which we acknowledge the disruption of continuity, its preservation in new forms, but also genuine novelty. So maybe I'm trying to ask about less the possibility of some purity than the possibility of emancipation and novel forms of domination too. So let me just, you know, concretize this for both of you. You know, Maggie and I have dialogued about the you know, since David invoked Geronimo, the continuities between Indian War, so-called, and the War on Terror, and, you know, the fact that, John, you cited George Henry Williams and, you know, in the military commission's opinion and so forth. That's an example of a place in the paper, the Harvard Law Review piece, where you lean into continuity or strongly suggest it. Kesu, I don't really, you know, have a great example, but I'm going to refer to the many reviews you and I have both read, the annoying ones of our mutual friend Walter Johnson's, you know, extraordinary book about my hometown, St. Louis, that basically say, Walter, this is just a story of unending, undifferentiated domination for which there's no exit. The exits that liberals insist, you know, they, you know, claim to bring about. So I do want to get at how it's possible to acknowledge change and novelty as well as novel forms of evil, or if you like, taint, without conceding, you know, too much to the in the wrong direction. So maybe Maggie first.
So I think we maybe even talked about this in the context of your book chapter that I read, where you had said, well, this is all discontinuous. And so we don't really need to understand the rest of this, the Indian Wars anyways. Maybe I'm completely paraphrasing that one.
At all what was said.
I'm so sorry.
it's that there are novel forms in the war on terror, including under law, that actually depart substantially from the Indian war frameworks, and that's what's bad, because there are some novel phenomena that we have to reckon with.
Right.
But it's not really about that claim. It's more about just like theoretically, how do we assess in plausible ways change?
No, and I think that it's an interesting question in the context of what history does and the work of this ideology and the idea of interrogating these universal presumptions that we hold now. So a lot of my work is trying to show those continuities in order to show, look, these visions of universal natural world that we now hold in the present is actually not as universal, is not as natural as we presume it to be. And so the history there, we can see the continuities. And I lean into the continuities to show that there are continuities there, to show that this is actually something where it's not just a one-off. Because this is what happened in Hawaii, Trumpy Hawaii. We had the court went, Korematsu, one-off, complete one accident here. This is something that we did, you know, once. It had to do with race. It was World War II, right? Totally exceptional circumstances. World War II had no connection to any other war that we were engaged in. And we made a mistake and we're wrong now. So what we're doing now is wholly different, even though the logic of the exact rule and test that we're applying in this context is the same. The governance that we're applying is the same. The idea of separation of powers is the same, but we're not doing that thing that we did over there, even though it looks identical. I think that the continuities need to be seen before the nuance is then shown. And this is, I think, the conversation we had about your book that I'm flattening too much, and I apologize. But the idea that we don't want to say we don't need to see this connection
right.
First because it's been so erased. So we have a vision that is far too simplified and far too exclusive. Let's bring it in, and then let's argue about the nuances of, you know, the law of war in the Indian Wars and its continuity for like just or unjust war and violence into the 20th and 21st century. Let's have that conversation, right? But let's first have a conversation that Native people existed in the 19th century and that there were wars and that there was indefinite detention that may look like indefinite detention that we do today with all sorts of people who are similarly racialized and similarly at the margins of empire, and just happen to have a bit of a logic to them. I'm happy to have this detailed conversation about the nuances, but it is really difficult. And this is something where I had to hit this methodologically. As I've said, every Indian law paper starts with 8 pages of the history of Native people from the founding, because we have to explain it, because we're starting with first principles. We never get to those detailed, nuanced conversations that are beautiful and theoretical. So everyone looks at the field of federal Indian law and goes, well, golly, that's overly simplified. And you're like, well, yes, because the conversation that we have are starting from scratch over and over and over again. They're saying, look, there are Native people there. And they're like, wow, there were Native people there? They have treaties? Tell me what a treaty is. Did that go through the same process as other treaties? And you're like, yes, okay, let's get back there. So I think that you're right that this world, and I think in history, it's actually an even more difficult conversation because the field itself is so far ahead of the law in this area. So Native history is a much more developed field than Native political science. The Native sociology and Native federal Indian law or Indian law in the legal academy. But I would love to get to a point where I'm having those nuanced conversations.
I want to let Casey answer her question, but it sounds to me like there's something super interesting right there, which was the interaction between the doctrinal problems and then the legal form. So like the law review form, which is when these discussions and like prizes that the 15 page like starting at beginning forms, and it's I just wondered whether it's something about the form in addition to everything else.
You know, it's talks too. It's every single interaction I have. Sadly, it starts at first principles, and that's okay. That's part of why I got into. I mean, I could have gone and become like a medical doctor, for example. Like this is the path that I chose. And it's one where I could just stick to working within the trenches on that law and not have these conversations. These conversations are hard. Having conversations with people who are doing con law for decades, who have studied immigration for decades and saying, all right, let's look at this, is really, really difficult. And my hope is to get past that first step into the nuance, because I think the nuance is exactly right. We can get into the whole settler colonialism conversation, which is, I think, what came out of Walter Johnson's book to a degree. I think settler colonialism is an overly simplistic framework that actually erases the agency of Native people and the nuances on the ground. I think that that's right. I mean, Richard White, says, I don't know what settler colonialism is. And I think that's right. Middle ground is not settler colonialism. It is contingency and mess and beautiful interaction, but it's also agency and it's Native agency. And I think we'll start to miss something if we erase that too. And we will start to miss the way that people who are subordinated participate in their own subordination. And that's not a good thing, but it's something we can't erase away. And still understand how the system works.
Okay, Sue, do you want to weigh in on any of this?
I think there is a difference between the history of what has happened to groups over time in American history and the history of the institutions that we have wrought and why they work the way they do. Going back to Maggie's story about power, I mean, I think the story of who's been in power has been somewhat consistent. I mean, obviously there have been power struggles, but largely non-white peoples have had not a lot of political power or been in control of those institutions and the way those institutions have developed. And yet all of the resistance that they have posed through their organizing on the ground has also led to real changes, real institutional changes that we do not center in our study of law in law schools. Also provide tons of material for thinking about the way that the law changes and the way power struggles over law take place, and that these are things that we need to be thinking about. It's so obvious that this is what is happening now, and we do our students a huge disservice when we don't look at hundreds of years of the history of how this happened, focusing only on the stories of the principles the victors hold up after the fact to say, why those institutions work the way they do. That's a little bit simplified, but I do think that's part of the story that we have. Another thing that I would add on to to the conversation that was just happening here is that, as Maggie's pointed out, the fields of history are really far ahead. And Sam, you know this because you work with historians all the time. In a way, we're just importing things that are very, very well known by the field of history to the field of law and asking what the implications are for the institutions that we work within and on and study and teach. And that produces all sorts of new questions that I think would also benefit the field of history and the general public to think about these questions about how power in this country is constructed and how our institutions work. But it's a difficult thing, right? Because the ways of thinking about these questions about law are already extremely well established, and it feels incredibly hard to bring things in, even though they were established a long time ago in lots of other fields, right? To say that the histories of conquest and enslavement are foundational to property law is very upsetting to a lot of people in the field who've just never learned it that way, even though it's pretty well established by historians that the vast majority of all property at the time of the revolution was in stolen native lands and enslaved human beings. That's just not controversial. And I would think that it shouldn't be controversial to talk about how those enormous markets were put together and maintained and protected by law. And yet it's very difficult to make that intervention because of the strength of other narratives.
I want to follow up right there, because one of the things I thought was interesting, so I'm teaching property for the first time in the fall, first time I've been teaching other things, and I've sort of been going through the casebooks, the contemporary casebooks, not the historical casebooks. Maybe I should look at the old ones too. But one of the things I found about the contemporary casebooks is that all the materials are so hoary and old. So like they pretend that the way we regulate nuisance is common law cases as opposed to zoning boards. Like zoning is a little thing in the back, whereas we have 18 nuisance cases, whereas in reality, zoning is how we regulate nuisance, and the cases are kind of a little backwater. They pretend that springing interests and the rule against perpetuities rather than the Uniform Trust Act is how we regulate bequests. They don't even talk about things like property taxes, which are like extraordinarily important ways we regulate real property, but it's somehow not property law. And so focusing on the way that property law is weirdly treated as a common law subject, when I think it's properly thought of today as a administrative and statutory subject, has ways it rhymes with your story and ways it conflicts a little bit. And so the way it rhymes is that it suggests that property law is always a product of the state and that the project of governments will not be constrained by common law doctrine. So a state committed to the expropriation of native property won't worry about fee tails too much. They'll come up with a legal innovation away, and one that wants to limit building tall buildings in rich suburbs will not care about the ancient lights doctrine. It's just like they'll make it up if they have to. And the legal creativity is sufficiently strong that it can achieve the most important ends of the state. Maybe it's limited in some ways or shaped, but like if they really are committed to something, it'll get done. I mean, so that rhymes with your story and thought, and so I thought that was quite interesting. On the other hand, it creates a bit more of a break between past and present. So there's nothing about the kind of racial basis of Locke's labor theory that makes us create zoning boards. Like, it's not a necessary component of them, or regulate mortgages the way we did in the post-war period. Lots of things that had a similar history do behave differently. And we see lots of divergence across U.S. states. So not with mortgages, because that's, but certainly with land use, like, Houston does not look like San Francisco, right? And like, they have a similar history in this respect. If you think that property regulation is mostly a product of modern property, 20th century state building, much more than it is a product of 18th century, never mind six, as you know, like weird English nonsense. It suggests that the flaws in our property system, and I suspect we disagree about what those are, but are much more likely to be the flaws of 20th century politics. And of course, that itself has a historical root. But like, if I were thinking about the history that I was most concerned about the exclusion of in a property book, I don't know that I would go back to the 18th century as much as I'd be really concerned about, say, the creation of the federal mortgage system in the post-war New Deal era, right? Like that is the and redlining and all of that stuff. And so the question is first of all, do you agree with the characterization that property regulation is in fact like only kind of a common law subject, or the common law is a much less essential piece of it than case books generally allow, and that security, and then secondly, what implications do you think that for the history that is most, obviously you've got to make choices in a casebook or an article or whatever, but what the most essential pieces to highlight? Because again, there's lots of choices to make.
Yeah, there's tons of choices to make because it's this enormous history that goes on for centuries and there's so many different aspects of it. So thank you for asking this question. Your story about property sounds totally fascinating and I'd love to be in your property law class to learn more about it. Of course, I agree that not every history is continuous through all of this time. Of course, there are new evolutions, but I actually think that the examples that you name are a little bit more related than you think. This is the way that I teach about the 20th century developments in the mortgage market to my class. We go through the history of settlement And we talk about how the government really used incentives, incentivized private actors to go out and create enclosures in the first place, how they went ahead of law and beyond the federal survey and beyond the bounds that have been negotiated by federal treaties to invade and occupy Native nations' lands to create private property ahead of public jurisdiction. I think that's really a remarkable thing about our property system, that in very many cases, private property was created in order to extend public jurisdiction, not the other way around. This is a very, this is really upturning ideas that people have about sovereignty and property on their head. I think that this approach, you know, there's a lot of literature that says that this is due to constraints in not the federal government's vision, but in their ability to enforce and enact such a policy, right? They didn't have people that they could pay. They didn't have the capacity, the resources, all this small state theory stuff, weak state theory, pointing to the use of incentives to say, actually, the influence was just enormous. It was just diffuse because it was delegated to private actors. I think you see a very similar thing happening. I mean, the period you're talking about, the creation of the mortgage market as we know it today, there were a lot of choices. I mean, the home, Hulk, as you know, directly issued mortgages to people who were in trouble. The federal government was responsible for like a million mortgages directly lending and tracking these mortgages. They had the option of continuing to do that, but they didn't. What did they do? They incentivized private actors to create another type of private interest, a loan, by insuring them, by agreeing to guarantee them, spawning basically the generation of another commodity market, the debt commodity, right? Mortgages themselves. It's really the beginning to that. You can't do that without the enclosures that were incentivized in much the same way. And a mortgage then gets attached to every one of these enclosures that's created through this hundreds process, years long process of creating a nation of enclosures in the first place. And so I think actually there's really big patterns that are pretty clear that teach us really important lessons about sovereignty and jurisdiction. I agree with you that there is a, I mean, I sort of described this as why do we focus so much on common law doctrines derived from English doctrines regulating relationships between neighbors rather than the systemic aspects of the property system that really build the market. And I think you're pointing to some other kind of local government, state government ways of managing that system that are also big picture and important. I have focused on the ones that grow directly out of the kind of interests in private property that are constructed through the history I tell. So aspects of the title registration system that have changed, you know, things like the mortgage electronic registration system and the use of LLCs that end up taking beneficial ownership information out of the public record after it's been constructed through this history. And so I focus on the things, I focus on things like that in order to give students a sense of continuity. I also think they're very important. So that's what I would answer yes. you know, too many trees for the forest. I think the forest is a really important thing to teach in a property law class. And there's lots of ways that we're missing that. I think the things you propose adding sound interesting and good. I don't focus as much on that just in order to create more continuity between other things. But I do think it's all of those things combined. And the role of government regulation is really important. And in constructing the market, frankly, is really, really important.
So as a last question, and you know, we're coming to the end, I just want to inquire about the kind of the way your scholarship is enacting a politics of and about and within the law schools. And you know, the scholarship itself suggests that they will be relatively impervious to change, that even if we could imagine different teaching, not you know, it's not as if immediate consequences follow. On the other hand, it's powerful to think of a different legal education in which students emerge with a really radically different sense of the you know, ongoing participation in racial capitalist domination that our doctrines and frameworks have. And they've missed this entirely in 1L and many other courses. On the other hand, at least as far as we can imagine, these institutions are training people who are not doing scholarship. You know, some will, most won't. You've mentioned that even when legal education celebrates activism, it celebrates some kind rather than others and excludes some of what Kesu, at least, you know, and I think Maggie too, consider some of the most inspiring, if I can use that word. So what do you imagine is the political significance of this work relative to those who will get exposed to your teaching and scholarship, and hopefully that of all of us through your influence, and then go out to do something in the world?
So I think in my federal Indian law class, which has been gaining, it seems like Native issues are gaining in popularity. And I think that the education that at least my version of federal Indian law offers is an education in the strategies of power movement and power movement lawyering, and how to work around those doctrines and to use the law, rule of law principles, things that are usually seen as like a conservative legal movement strategies towards ends. And just to make this very clear, this isn't a vision of power movements as better, but just a broadening of one's toolkit as a lawyer to try and understand the Congress as important and central to one's advocacy, the administrative state as central to one's advocacy, as is the court. And to broaden that toolkit to understand that this is the way that this power movement has functioned and has successfully built these structures. So for the students, they seem to be drawn more and more to this, I think in part because of Black Lives Matter and the resurgence of conversations around power to the fore of how social movements are operating and what they're calling for. You've seen, I think the Yale Law Journal has published like a number of articles with the word power in the title. So abolition papers on rethinking through a power lens. You have like Kate Andreas and Ben Sachs' paper on using power. And so trying, is that on power? Oh, great. So again, like this feeds right into it. There's a vision where understanding how power works, it helps to push back on this liberalism, this vision of liberalism that is really sedimented into progressive lawyering that sees rights, judicial solicitude, and federal oversight as the solution. And I think that we're giving students a broader vision of how the world works and what they can do to influence it moving forward, and an alternative to something that they think is wholly unfixed by law. So rather than saying law has failed us, you could see in the context of federal Indian law, the way that law has at least held on to build these infrastructures, to shift power. I mean, there's a constitutional framework in the United States that's like consociational democracy that like nobody studies. It's fascinating and it's wonderful. And Native people did that in a particular way through particular forms of advocacy. And I think it would help all of us to better understand that. Also because other power movements use the same strategies. And so when we all woke up in 2016 and went, wow, the world is so shocking today, the same way we woke up with McGirt and said, wow, the world is so shocking today, we understand that power movements like white power movements are also operating in similar ways. So we can understand what we're working against as well. And so there is a pedagogical benefit. There's a benefit for students, but I think there's also a benefit, I'm sorry, moving back to theorists and our understanding of the law, our understanding of our government, it doesn't benefit us to not actually see the whole problem, to see the whole government. I mean, we're doing this edited volume, not to plug my work too much, I apologize, but on a dual volume, edited volume on rethinking the history of American democracy through the Tobin Project. I know it's a very small, very humble title, there we are essentially taking to task the field of history, especially around political history, to push in social and cultural histories to try and understand better how our government has worked. Because historians are really just on the verge of doing this as well. We're at a moment where we understand that our models have not told us, they've not been predictive, they've not captured the whole story, and that we're re-entrenching yet again into another iteration of a problem. And I think taking the veil off may be a good start for everyone. And I think that this this history, this doctrine, Native people, they have a lot to teach. We have a lot to teach. And I think that all of us, law students and law faculty most especially, would benefit, even if Native people themselves might be damaged by being pushed into the public eye, because the public eye tends to subordinate.
I would only add to that, I think there's lots of different levels at which this is a practical endeavor, I would say, on the level of advocacy, like Maggie was just talking about, in terms of turning people's attention to the different kinds of institutions at which they might advocate, but also what kinds of data they might be looking at. And this is a broader collective project that journalists are engaging in, as well as historians. And the popular discourse is changing so fast in terms of what's coming up when we look at sort of the consequences of the institutions that we have and the practices that are taking place within them. I think this conversation is also, you know, we have all at one point talked about the larger systemic issues that get lost if we sort of just take the rote curriculum and just regurgitate it without sort of looking at these broader structures and how things are working. And we have a lot of students who are going to be a part of reimagining these institutions, hopefully, or working in government and have a role in thinking of other ways to approach problems. So I think all of that is important. And then the sort of most, the sort of longest term, least satisfying, sort of what you're saying, Tim, seemingly sometimes impervious to change, the epistemological project that we're all engaging in is, of course, a little more out of our control, less predictable. But I would just say, as someone who's been working on this now for over a decade, the epistemological leaps and bounds that have taken place in public discourse, I never would have anticipated all of that happening, and how much different it is to talk about the work I do now than it was 5 years ago, or certainly 10 years ago. And so I think these kinds of epistemological shifts present a lot of opportunity, and we need to be ready in terms of our thinking about institutions for when they happen. There's so much that is here. And one thing I stress a lot in the dimension of the epistemological project especially is just this is work that everyone really needs to do. I think when Maggie and I are pointing to these histories and saying, well, for 130 years, they've largely been suppressed. So we're kind of just at the beginning of thinking through what the consequences are for all of these institutions. Everyone is going to have to do some thinking about that. And I think it's really surprising and gratifying, actually, to see that that is less controversial than it was a very short time ago. And so these projects are working on many different levels. I would just point that out. And some of them, I think we could see come to fruition a little faster than others. But the gamble is, you know, the sort of longer term effects that nobody knows, you know, nobody knows exactly what's going to happen.
So Sam and I disagree about many things, but one thing we do agree on, and it's a deep ideological commitment of this podcast, is to plugging our work. Contrary to Maggie's conversation, the work here is really terrific and fascinating. I want to thank Maggie and Kaysu for coming on. Links to the work will be attached to the pod description, but really, thank you. This was awesome. So thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you. Thank you both so much. Thank you all.
Fantastic. Thank you.